Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa School of Social Work, offering the opportunity to earn a master's degree from anywhere in Iowa, including an all-online MSW program. Information at socialwork.uiowa.edu.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nubby. It's Horticulture Day today, and this has been a very eventful summer. Happily, it hasn't been all that eventful when it comes to invasive insects in Iowa. In about 15 minutes, Iowa State University Extension horticulture specialist Richard Giron will be here to answer your plant questions, but we're going to start the hour with a 2020 insect update. Donald Lewis is a professor of entomology at Iowa State University. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity. Good to be here.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here, and very easy to talk about summer in the past tense right now as we get some late October weather to kick off fall with.
It feels gloomy out there today, at least in Ames.
Yeah, I think it does in a lot of Iowa today. Well, let's talk about insects this summer, because, of course, at the beginning of the summer, I always ask you to be clairvoyant and tell us what we're going to expect. But it's a lot easier to use some hindsight. We started off back when the pandemic struck. People then were suddenly terrified of the so-called murder hornets, the Asian giant hornets. Did they come to Iowa?
No, they did not happen. We were all prepared. We had everybody looking at pictures to see what the Asian giant hornet looked like. They're large. They're 1.5 to 2 inches long. They have that bright orange head, the orange and black markings on their abdomen. We had people primed looking for them, and people did look for them. The citizens of Iowa were very diligent in looking for large wasps and letting us know that they had found them. We've looked at over 100 pictures and talked to people about what they saw in their yard, and none of those turned out to be Asian giant hornets. So another bullet dodged.
Excellent. They were probably almost all cicada killer wasps.
Yes, they were, with a couple of other large things thrown in. Of course, cicada killer wasp is our largest wasp, but only 1.5 inches. They have kind of a black and white or a black and yellow stripe pattern with orange-colored wings, but they burrow in the ground by themselves, and that's a big difference between the cicada killer and the Asian giant hornet. The cicada killer is a solitary wasp, that is, each nest has only one female doing all the digging, all the food provisioning, all of the laying of eggs by herself. Asian giant hornet is more like our bald-faced hornet or our yellow jacket wasps, where they are social. There is a colony of workers that are serving a queen to raise the colony and eventually protect the colony. But yes, cicada killer wasp was very prominent this year. I don't know that we had more of them, but at least people noticed them more because
more
we were
pictures.
Looking. Yes.
All right. Well, let's talk about the Asian long-horned beetle. That's another invasive species that we have been expecting and dreading, right?
Well, since 1996, when the Asian long-horned beetle, we got to keep our insect names very clear here. We're talking about a wood-boring beetle this time that attacks and kills trees. It has a preference for maple trees. It's another one that arrived in port areas, probably in wooden shipping crates from Asia. And when it gets to the United States, it finds lots of maple trees and begins boring into them as larvae, which essentially ruins the tree. And then those trees start to die. The Asian longhorn beetle, named for its really long antennae, has been found in 6 different states. The closest to us was Chicago, but the Chicago infestation was eradicated by a clear-cutting technique where every time they found a beetle, they went around that in a circle and cut down all the trees. So of the 6 states that have experienced Asian longhorn beetle, there's only 3 of them left that have active infestations. That's Ohio, New York, and Massachusetts. So as long as people leave firewood where they burn it, where they got it, and don't transport it across state lines, maybe we will continue to dodge this bullet a little longer, because we have an overabundance of maple trees, and if there was an insect that preferred maple, we would really be in big trouble.
Absolutely. All right. Well, that's excellent news. Mosquitoes are not an invasive species, but we have good news there too, right?
We started off with all those wet spring weather. We had lots of rainfall, but it stayed cool during that rain period. So mosquitoes didn't really build a big spring population. And then we went into a summer, and people who are looking at their brown lawns or looking at their corn crop that has dried up realized we didn't get a lot of rain through the summer, and that means we didn't get a lot of mosquitoes. So good news for gardeners, for people who like to be outside picnicking and working in their yard and so forth. We did not have to use quite as much insect repellent on our exposed skin this year. So the weather did us a favor by limiting the number of mosquitoes, but that was no favor to gardeners and farmers.
No, absolutely not. Although we are making up a little bit of ground this week, which is late for a lot of gardeners and farmers, but it's still good to get the rain. Let's talk about the European paper wasp. That's, again, another invasive species, and it really seemed like it was spreading everywhere for a while.
We reported the European paper wasp back in 2012. This is just like the other paper wasps, the ones that you may be familiar with up under the eaves of your house. They build exposed combs. It's a social wasp where there's a queen and a colony that goes out and collects caterpillars and flies, brings them back, chops up those pieces of food, and feeds it to the queen's offspring. This particular wasp, the European paper wasp, was going to be more of a menace than some of the others because of its preference for feeding on caterpillars. And for people who are raising milkweeds in hopes of raising more monarch caterpillars, were losing their caterpillars to this particular wasp. So it looked like it was going to be bad news because of the threat of being stung. It loves to nest in urban areas. It loves to eat our caterpillars. But it has sort of diminished here in the state. We have not been able to find as many of them over the last two summers as we did back in 2012 when it was a new insect. So I don't think they've gone away. I think they've just settled into a low number, and we hope it stays that way.
Absolutely. All right. Now, those are all of the things, the stories that were not the stories of 2020. Let's talk about the things that were notable that did happen this summer.
Everybody experienced Japanese beetles again. Well, not everybody. It seems like we're still at about two-thirds of the counties in the state have seen Japanese beetle, and it's been here since 1994. But not everybody knows it. Not everybody has seen it. But every year, it appears the Japanese beetle is new to somebody. That is, they didn't have it in their backyard before. Now they have it. They're in a panic because their linden tree is turning brown, their crabapple tree is turning brown, they're losing the leaves off their grapes. Others of us have been through this. We know that the trees will survive. We know it looks ugly for a brief period. But Japanese beetle attracts a lot of attention because it's always new to somebody. But it's a pest that the country has lived with for a long time. It was first found in the United States as an invasive species back in 1916. So we have a lot of experience and we know we will live through it. But more and more people are seeing the Japanese beetle as it moves around the state. There still have been none reported in the northeast corner or down in south central Iowa. But most of the rest of us in the state know what the Japanese beetle is and know what it's capable of.
Yeah, all too familiar with it. We have a new caterpillar pest this summer?
You know, it's an interesting thing that insects arrive and they just don't attract a lot of attention until suddenly someone notices it and says, wait a minute, what is this odd-looking caterpillar on my dill plants? It turns out we have had the purple carrot seed moth in the state for a few years, but this summer we had people reporting it as a pest of dill. Now, why would you care if there's a caterpillar eating your dill? Well, because you wanted the dill to make pickles, of course, but also many people raise dill and its related plants in their garden because that is the food of the black swallowtail caterpillar. So they have a butterfly garden, they have this plant for one particular caterpillar, and suddenly they found this other one, the caterpillar of the purple carrot seed moth. It's a small caterpillar, it's a small moth with a big long name. I don't know why purple has to be in there, but the purple carrot seed moth caterpillar was reported to us this year, and we're going to watch now for this invasive insect as well.
Well, adding in the purple makes it sound delightful. I think it sounds like a children's book, but well, maybe we should do that with all the invasive species.
Give them cute names. Right. Maybe we would love them. But this one feeds on dill and carrots and all those related plants, so you would think it would only feed on purple carrots, which I have learned over the years is actually a thing. Who knew carrots could be purple? But it feeds on all carrots and all dill as well. So just another interesting insect and one that was new to me this summer.
All right. Let's talk about carpenter bees and where they were this summer.
Carpenter bee is an interesting one. I knew about it in Ohio when I left there a long, long time ago, and then I didn't hear about them when I came to Iowa, and except they were way down in Lee County. Carpenter bee is a big bee. It's the size of a bumblebee, but it's shiny black. It's not fuzzy on the abdomen like a carpenter, like a bumblebee would be. And carpenter bees work in wood, just like you would expect from the name carpenter bee. So 43 years ago when I started, we had almost no reports. Now we have documented the presence of the carpenter bee burrowing into the rafter tails and the floor joists of people's houses and barns and sheds as far north as Ames. So this is an insect that has expanded its distribution. It used to be a southern pest, and now it's a central Iowa pest, but much larger distribution over the last 40 years. It is a beneficial insect. Carpenter bees are pollinators. They visit flowers to gather pollen and nectar that they put into dime-sized holes that are drilled into bare wood. It's the drilling that makes them a pest. We would like to preserve them because they're pollinators, but because they're drilling into the joists of your deck, they're creating a lot of sawdust and a lot of annoyance.
All right. Well, we are out of time for right now. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes. We haven't yet warned of the fall invasion of Asian lady beetles and brown marbored stink bugs, but you know they're coming, and it's time to seal up all of those cracks. So we'll get back to talking about insects and plants in just a moment. And of course, you can join the conversation with your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Entomologist Donald Lewis here with me right now. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa School of Social Work, offering the opportunity to earn a master's degree from anywhere in Iowa, including an all-online MSW program. Information at socialwork.uiowa.edu.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today with me, Iowa State University entomologist Donald Lewis, and also joining us, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron. Hello, Richard. Oh, I should put you on the air, Richard, before I say hello. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And of course, we keep talking about the drought across Iowa. We are getting some much needed rain this week, and some of it's in time for farmers and gardeners in some parts of the state.
Well, probably not so much for field crops, but as far as the landscape, the trees, the shrubs, perennials, the grass, the rain has been very, very welcome.
Yes, so I am not enjoying any of it, but it's good to have it.
These gray days, if it's raining, I like it.
So. Okay, all right. I'm going to try to embrace that attitude. It didn't have to come with cold temperatures, in my personal opinion, but we'll enjoy the rain and we'll get through it, and sunshine's coming on Sunday. You can join our conversation with your questions, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Bob is on the line. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I have a question about Japanese beetles. I have blackberry plants and grape vines, and they seem to really like those. And my theory is for every female I pick off and drop in a bucket of water, that's 100 fewer eggs in my yard. So that adds up. But anyway, if I have a bucket full of dead beetles, are there any viable eggs in there? Should I dump them in my compost pile or just dump them somewhere away from my garden and yard?
You can dump them wherever it's convenient for you. No, there are no viable eggs. The female has to put the eggs into moist soil in order for those eggs to survive, for those eggs to thrive. And then at the moment the egg hatches, the little tiny grub has to find a grass root to begin feeding in order to survive. So it's kind of risky to be a Japanese beetle egg and to be a Japanese beetle grub, but enough of them make it. So no, there are no viable eggs. You don't have to worry about them being hatching wherever you scatter them. My suggestion is you scatter them in a very thin layer because they're going to stink as they start to decompose, and you don't want a big mound of them in any one place. So spread them out. Now, the theory that eliminating beetles in the fall, in the summer, protects your lawn doesn't seem to hold up. And that's because these beetles are highly mobile, and they may have laid eggs in the grass before they got to your blackberries and to your grapes. So it's two problems. It's white grubs in the ground, and it's beetles on the plants. And if you're going to control them, you have to control them in both places.
All right. Bob, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Here's a question from Jim. He says, I want to save the seeds of my Bradford watermelons, and I have a couple of questions. First, are all the seeds in one watermelon genetically identical? In other words, did the female flower get pollinated by the pollen of only one male flower?
Now, as far as the seed, if it's a cultivated variety, if it's a hybrid, you can save the seed, but it's not going to be genetically identical to the parent. If you have an heirloom-type watermelon variety, and there's no other variety in the area as far as a watermelon, then it should be pretty true to type, but if it's a hybrid, it's not going to be.
Okay, well, he's wondering if he wants to plant the seeds from more than one watermelon next spring.
No, he doesn't have to. I mean, they're self-fertile, and so if you have just a single variety, they'll produce fruit. They have separate male and female flowers, and when the female flower is pollinated, it will form a fruit.
He says that he's read that to get the best seeds, one has to leave the melon on the plant longer than if harvesting to eat it. Is that true?
You basically want to harvest it when it's ripe. And when it's ripe and you can eat it, the seeds should be viable.
Oh, good. So you can have your melon and eat it
and
too.
Save the seeds.
And save the seeds. Great. All right. Here's a question from Mary. What is the timing for the application of weed and feed on lawns this fall? And do we have to worry about how dry it was until this week?
The rain has been very helpful in that regard, in that the rain has kind of revived the grass, but also the weeds. Okay. So they will readily absorb the herbicide. So it should be quite effective. But I would wait a little bit longer. The best time basically is between late September and mid-November. So typically October is ideal.
All right. From Derek in Iowa City, bees have kind of taken over our bird bath, a dozen or more all day long. We don't begrudge them water, but the birds don't seem to like them and don't use the bath much when they're there. The bees are not aggressive. This started in late summer. Is it a seasonal thing? Donald?
Bees need water, and honeybees we're talking about, and I assume that's the question is about honeybees. They do need water, and they will get that from a nearby source, and the bird bath just happens to be one. Now, one way to do that would be to put another water source closer to wherever the bees are coming from, which you may or may not know, so you'll have to do some observation to see if you can track them coming in. But
You know, I think birds and bees get along okay. We always talk about them in the same sentence. It seems like they should be able to use the same bird bath. But birds are going to be there at one time of the day. Maybe the bees are there in the middle of the day. So I wouldn't worry quite so much about it. But this is a common question. Why are there bees in my bird bath? Well, bees need water, too.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. John is on the line in Beaverdale. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, I've got a deciduous magnolia, star mag, out in my backyard. It's fairly mature, probably 10, 12 years old, 25 feet high. It is covered with magnolia scale. Mm-hmm. And I know there's a product called Ape that may sells, and I'm leery of all pesticides. I know it kills the bugs you don't like, but it kills the bugs you like, too, and birds maybe, and who knows what all else. So what's the prognosis for my magnolia if I just don't do anything to it?
Not good. Magnolia scale is a large scale. They're a little less than half an inch in diameter when the females are fully enlarged and producing eggs. And as they feed on the sap, they create a lot of honeydew. The honeydew produces a lot of sooty mold. So your magnolia is ugly. It's shiny, sticky, and it's black in addition to being stunted by the sap feeding of the scale. This can be fatal. I have lost a branch off of my star magnolia because I was kind of watching the magnolia scale and enjoying studying them and realized they had killed that branch. So something probably has to be done. Now, one option, the insecticide 8 is a contact insecticide, and you would put that on in the spring to try to coincide with the crawler stage. And that is a little difficult to time. We think it's August through September, so that might be now to control the crawler stage. Your other option is to use a systemic insecticide that you put on the soil just around the base of the plant. Let the insecticide go up through the plant. It will be in the sap, and it will be toxic to insects that feed on the sap from those plants, which are the magnolia scales. So I agree with you that we don't want to use insecticides beyond what we have to, but this is one where you may have to say, I need to protect this plant, and so I will choose one of these two options, either the insecticide on the twigs now or a systemic insecticide in the spring or a systemic insecticide to try to kill them internally.
Yeah, what's the chemistry of the systemic insecticide, or the name? I don't know if you can give me a brand name.
Imidacloprid is one of the neonicotinoids. Imidacloprid would be probably the most readily available. Now, neonicotinoids have a bad reputation because they also appear in the flowers. And if there are bees and flies visiting the flowers of the treated plants, they may pick up a toxic dose. I think that's less of a problem with magnolia because of the timing of this and so forth. Early summer would have been our choice for putting on this systemic insecticide, so it's in there as the scales are enlarging. Sure. But imidacloprid would be the name you're looking for. Lots and lots of trade names out there.
Amino what? A-M-I-N-O?
Amida. I-M-I-D-A-C-L-O-P-R-I-D. Imidacloprid.
All right, John, thank you so much for your call. Next up, let's go to Bill in Independence. Hi, Bill.
Good morning.
Hi.
I have a question on when to transplant oriental lilies. We live in a rural area in northeast Iowa.
Okay. I would do it probably around early to mid-October. I would cut them off at the ground as far as the foliage, carefully dig up the bulbs, and put them right back in the ground.
What if they've already died back? Still trim them off of the ground?
Yeah, I would. And I'd probably still wait till October to move them, actually. Just know where they are and dig them up at that point.
All right, Bill, thanks a lot for your call. And next up, Joanne in Des Moines. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. I guess I just have a comment. If you can comment on this, I had lots of dragonflies in my yard this year. I hardly ever see a dragonfly unless you go to a pond or something like that. And I could sit in my lawn chair and look up, and there'd be, I don't know, 7, 8, 9, 10 of them flying around up above me. Why did I have them? I like them, but where'd they come from?
You were just lucky, and I hope you relished the moment, because it may be a while before it happens again. I've had that same phenomenon standing in the street in front of my house, and in my case, I thought it was dozens of dragonflies that were zigzagging back and forth in the air, anywhere from 6 to 12 feet off the ground, and I'm not even close to water where the dragonflies develop, but they just seem to move to these areas and have a feeding frenzy, and that's what you watched. In the air at the time with the dragonflies were probably winged ants or gnats or some other small insect. Depending on the time of day, it could have been mosquitoes. And dragonflies hold their front legs like a basket under their chin, and as they're zigzagging through the air, they are scooping insects out of midair, and then the basket sort of tips up and they eat the prey as they're flying. So it's a great thing to watch, and I'm glad it happened to you, and I hope it happens again sometime for me, and I hope it happens again for you.
Joanne, thank you so much for your call. And next, let's talk to Joyce. Hello, Joyce.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering when I should cut the hostas off, or if not even cut them off, should they be left over the winter?
I would be inclined to clean them up probably late October once they are basically collapsed on the ground. They really don't provide much habitat for insects or anything like that. So I would be inclined to clean them up in late October.
All right, Joyce.
And I would just use a pruning shears or something of that nature. Just cut them off.
Thanks a lot for your call. And next, let's talk to Michael in Harper. Hi, Michael.
Hello. Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have dug up a whole bunch of little oak seedlings out in my grove, little 6 to 8 inch, and I've potted them in 12 inch pots about 5 or 6 days ago, and they appear to be very, very healthy. And how do I winter them?
You basically have a couple options. One actually is to dig a large hole or trench as far as wide, and just put those pots in the ground, and then place soil around the pots as if planting the actual tree. And then you could put chicken wire fencing or hardware cloth fencing around it to make sure the rabbits don't get them, and they should be fine that way. The other option would be if you have like a unheated garage, where you simply put them in there around mid-November, check on them periodically, make sure they're not drying out, and water them if they are. But they should be fine in that unheated garage, too.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Michael. And boy, seedlings are in demand right now. Here's a question from Sam. He says, I found signs of carpenter bees on my deck support posts. If I see one or two holes, should I assume that there are a lot of carpenter bees in the area, or could it be just a random act? What can I do to prevent them?
Each hole is made by one female. And so if you only have two holes, maybe both holes were made by the one female. So it's a very low number that have discovered the bare wood of the deck post and have started to drill there. So I wouldn't worry about it. Now, I'm not a structural engineer, so I can't tell you how weak that post is because of a hole that could be a half inch in diameter and 6 to 8 inches long inside the post. So eventually there may be enough damage that we worry about the structure, but until then, it's just another part of nature that we get to watch and enjoy.
All right, and here's a question from Earl. I don't see mole or gopher mounds in my yard, but there's something burrowing through the soil around the perimeter of several mature trees. Any idea what it could be? The soil has been turned up around the base of these trees, and I was wondering what animal is causing this. It's almost like a tunnel around the base, but there aren't any mole or gopher hills. I know that's not either of your area of expertise.
Yeah. Now you don't have to see an actual mound to have a mold damage, in that they basically will tunnel just beneath the surface, and they will lift up the ground. And so you don't have to see a mound associated with that. But typically, when it's dry like it has been, they tend to be much deeper in the ground. And so we didn't see much activity, basically, like in July and August, for that reason. But if they're seeing a raised ridge where the ground has been lifted up, that typically would be a mole.
Okay, so it's likely that even if you're not seeing what you think you should see, it's probably a mole in this case.
Right, you don't have to see a mound of dirt to have actual mole activity, right?
All right, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio, and you can join the conversation with your questions, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. Send email to Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio, or at iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron and Iowa State University Professor of Entomology Donald Lewis. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. You are welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Iowa State University entomologist Donald Lewis and Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron. And here's a question from Virginia for you, Richard. She says, will you recommend a fast medium growing tree for the west side of my home where my master honey locust trees were destroyed by the derecho? They're the shade master honey locust trees. Please suggest a few varieties. I live on an acreage with many varieties of trees and nothing survived unscathed.
I would consider a linden. They're not fast, but I would say moderate as far as growth rate. And there are many cultivars. I would look at an oak, like a red oak. And for oaks, red oaks grow fairly rapidly. So that would be a possibility, too.
All right. And I'm sure a lot of people are trying to come up with what to plant and then how to find those seedlings. Here's a question from Ellen. Donald, my son sent me a story from Colorado Extension Service that there's a new treatment to kill Japanese beetles known as BTG. Do you know anything about this? She says it's related to thuricide.
BT is Bacillus thuringiensis, and there are dozens of strains of Bacillus thuringiensis. For the last 50 years or so, the one we've used to kill caterpillars is BTK, Bacillus thuringiensis christaki. This one is BTG, Bacillus thuringiensis galleria, and it is a strain of BT that is effective against both Japanese beetle adults, which is just weird, and also Japanese beetle larvae. Now, it's a bacterium that has to be produced in stainless steel vats in a factory somewhere. It's a hard one to produce, apparently. It's in fairly limited supply, and you know what that means for the cost. It's very expensive, but it is an organic, a bacterial control for one of our major pests. Now, the problem with bacteria for control of an insect, especially up in the air, is when Japanese beetles are present for over a six-week period, you're going to have to spray 3 to 5 times more if it rains. So an expensive product sprayed 3 to 5 times makes Japanese beetle control probably cost prohibitive, but it's an option that's out there, and we hope as they get better at producing this bacterium, the cost comes down.
All right, so a promising development, but not necessarily a solution right now.
It's a solution if you're willing to pay for it, and that's the issue. It's an expensive treatment compared to the synthetic products that are out there. But if you're looking for an alternative, it's one of the few that we have available to us. And Early research indicated that it did work against the Japanese beetle adults. It just has to be applied and reapplied frequently.
Let's go back to the phones. Debbie is on the line now in Oskaloosa. Hi, Debbie.
Hi.
What's your question?
Yes, I was warned about my African violets. I got one plant from my church where they give them out, you know, and I swear there's two growing together in there, and it's not blooming. Why? And I bought blooming food from Hy-Vee Flower Gift Shop, and I've been giving it to it, but it never produces any blooms for me. Why?
Well, there's two things there. One is that when you fertilize, you don't want to overdo it, because if you fertilize too much, you encourage leafy growth and actually inhibit flowering. So fertilize, but fertilize lightly. The other thing is they need quite a bit of light. They don't want direct sun, but they do need to be near a window where they get bright light. If they don't get enough light, they're not going to bloom either. So don't fertilize too much and make sure it has plenty of light.
All right, Debbie, thanks a lot for your call. Rick is next in West Des Moines. Hi, Rick.
Hello. Quick question. I have many boxwoods on my property, some mature, some new, and some of them are showing some signs of brown leaves. Do I just cut out those little stalks, or should I be treating it with something?
I don't think treatment is an option, but if it's just a little bit of tip growth that's brown, I would just cut it off. Now, if it becomes more widespread, then the actual cause needs to be identified, where you might want to send some photos to the plant diagnostic clinic here on campus.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Rick. 866-780-9100 is the number. Ralph is on the line next in Grinnell. Hi, Ralph.
Hey.
What's your question?
So, with all these trees destroyed, there's a big cemetery up in Marshalltown that's well over 100 years old, and they lost over $900,000 worth of trees to get pulled out. Any suggestions on what kind of trees to plant in a cemetery?
Well, I think the key there would be to plant a wide diversity of trees. Basically oaks, maples, lindens, Kentucky coffee trees, linden, honey locust, a wide variety of trees. That's typically what you want to do, is have diversity. So a wide selection of different trees.
All right. Ralph, thanks a lot for your call. And on a related subject, this is from Maria in Cedar Rapids. She says, I'm looking to plant new trees after my old ones got destroyed in the derecho. Are there any rules / suggestions as to how close you can plant a new tree next to an old stump?
Basically, you can just move a few feet away. Now, if you try to plant exactly in the same spot, it's not going to work. You're probably going to run into the base of the trunk. So just move a few feet away, maybe 3, 4, 5 feet away, dig a hole and plant. You're fine.
All right. And let's go back to the phones. Now we've got Mary on the line in Mason City. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
What's your question?
Well, what's the best way to tell if a watermelon is ripe? We used to look for what I call the curl near the stem when that dried up. But I can't even see any curls on the watermelons we have, and I don't think they're ripe.
Yeah, that works on some varieties. On other varieties, it doesn't. Some people do the thumping test. I'm not very good at that, so I don't do that. To me, the most clear thing is to check the belly or the portion resting on the ground. And when that portion changes from kind of whitish to a creamy yellow color, then it's ripe.
Okay. One other question. With all this wet weather, my squash vines, the leaves kind of are turning whitish. Is that just from the humidity, or?
I would guess they probably have some type of mildew, possibly powdery mildew. And so this fall when the plants die, I would pull them up, and I would put them in the compost pile, but get them out of the garden and destroy them by some means.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Mary. And Bill is on the line next in Duncombe. Hi, Bill.
Good morning. I had a new first for me infestation of what was identified as sawflies when I discovered they were defoliating my willow trees. What can you tell me about sawflies?
There are lots and lots of sawflies, but the one that's on willow trees is a fairly large one, where these wrinkly white larvae up to 2 inches long with a black stripe down their back?
No, they were green.
Green, okay. One of the others, the one wasn't my first guess. Sawflies are wasps. They are a branch of the wasp family tree where the larvae feed on plants. Most wasp larvae feed on meat, but these are larvae of wasps that feed on plant material. By the time you see them, it's usually over with. The green ones probably are going to max out at about an inch in length. So what you see is likely to what you get. If you find them early enough, you can spray them with soapy water or horticultural oil or a contact insecticide. But defoliating a willow tree this late in the year is probably not going to be fatal, so we watch for it to happen next year, hope it doesn't happen, and hope to find it earlier in the season when it's still time to treat.
These were 2 to 3 inches in length.
Big ones. Okay.
Yes.
Sawflies on willow that are 2 inches long. Well, you've stumped me for a name, but we'll stick to sawflies and remind you that mark your calendar next year to be looking at the beginning to middle of August to see if this problem repeats on your willow tree, and be ready to, if you need the leaves to stay on the tree, if you need to protect from defoliation, it would have to have been sooner than the middle of September.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Bill. And it's time now to play Name That Weed with Jeff from Des Moines. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. Thank you for taking the call. There's a weed, the blossom, looks like crabgrass, but it comes back every year in the same place, and it spreads slowly. The plant itself kind of lays flat on the ground, and eventually just will take over where grass is and so forth. What is that called?
Boy, I'm not sure. It is a grass, but you said it has a seed head that looks like crabgrass?
Yeah, yes. You know how the fingers, how they
right,
all...
Right, right,
the only thing they break off.
The only thing that comes to mind is windmill grass. Windmill grass. And what happens is, with windmill grass, that seed head will eventually kind of break off, and then the wind will carry it. It kind of tumbles on the ground when
it
you have a...
That.
Okay, so it may be windmill grass, which is becoming more common in Iowa, and it's kind of hard to control. But that's what it may be, windmill grass.
Yeah, Roundup won't kill it, I don't think. You got to have something stronger than that.
I don't know of anything stronger than Roundup, so if that's not
well,
getting it.
There's like Spectracide. There's a product I get at Lowe's. It's called Spectracide. It's a grass and weed killer. Roundup for the lawn, I'm saying, doesn't really affect it that much. But anyways, I'll look up windmill grass, and if I have any more questions, I think I can take a picture and send it in to you, and
sure.
Maybe that'll help.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Jeff. Next up, let's go to Gerald in Winterset. Hi, Gerald.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you. I got spiders that show up in my bathroom, mostly bathrooms, real small, every 2 weeks or so. and I want to know how they get there. And I'll take it off the air. Thank you.
Okay, wait. Hold on, Gerald. Donald may have a follow-up there. Oh, he's gone.
He's gone. Yep. So we'll just have to guess. There are two kinds of spiders, those that live indoors and those that live outdoors. Outdoor spiders could be wandering in on an occasional basis, and we would expect those to be fairly large spiders like wolf spiders and grass spiders. The smaller spiders, like the cellar spider and the sack spider, live inside permanently. They are always a household resident. Sometimes they stay hidden, and we see them occasionally. So we probably don't have a great answer for what to do about it other than suck them up in the vacuum cleaner as you see them, seal up cracks and crevices, which you're going to do for the ladybugs and box elder bugs anyway, and if the problem persists, send me a picture.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. Let's go to Dennis in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Dennis.
Yeah, good morning. I live in Cedar Rapids and had a yard that was completely shaded for a long time, 100 years. And now what is the grass going to do underneath there? It did wonderfully before. I'm kind of concerned.
Well, what you may have to do if it's kind of thin is you may have to maybe overseed and put in basically bluegrass. That's our best adapted grass. And to do that, what you could do is probably next week, if you can get a core aerator, core aerate the yard where you pull out plugs of soil, yep. And then sow your grass seed, and then drag the area with like a piece of fencing or a drag mat, and that kind of works the seed into the soil, and then hopefully you'll get some of that grass to come up.
So the grass that I have now probably is going to suffer, you think?
Well, it may be the fine leaf fescue type, which does best in part shade, and it may have a tough time surviving long-term in full sun. So what I would probably do is sow some bluegrass seed, and the bluegrass seed should come up. And if the sun is too much for the fescue, it's going to die out, but you'll have the bluegrass.
Okay. I was kind of wondering about, how about fertilizer? I've never been one to use too much fertilizer. Is that something that would be helpful to the lawn after this interesting year?
I think so. You could fertilize basically now. And also late October, early November, either one or both. But it would be beneficial after a very stressful summer.
All right, Dennis, thank you so much for your call. Here's a question from Becky in Mason City for you, Donald. We had a beautiful stand of milkweed. It bloomed, then it became covered with tiny yellow aphids and small orange and black insects. They didn't leave anything for the monarchs, and we planted the milkweed for the monarchs.
I think there's about 500 different insects that will utilize milkweed as a food plant. The oleander aphid, those bright yellow aphids, are very common, and they're feeding on sap, so they should be able to coexist with the monarch caterpillars. The red and black beetle that we find on milkweeds is called the red milkweed beetle, and it feeds on the flowers, so it should be able to coexist. So plant more milkweed and enjoy the variety of insects that will visit it, and hope that the monarchs get their share.
All right. Donald Lewis, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Charity. It's always a pleasure.
Iowa State University Professor of Entomology, Donald Lewis. Richard Giron, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. And we will be back again next Friday with Horticulture Day from Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Have a great weekend.